Well, this is Alex Grant. Today's episode is brought to you by my new comic, Journey into Mexico, with Latin American artist Sebastian Guirobono, following the adventures of young T-Hax Tabares, who wields the power of
El Fuego,
during a very politically hot time in 1830s Mexico. Available in both English and Spanish on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Kindle, Comixology, and other retail online booksellers, such as IndiePlanet.com. Cheers, and let's get started. Welcome again to the Comic Book Historians Podcast with Alex Rand and Jim Thompson. Today we have one of our comic book heroes, famous writer Don McGregor. Don, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, guys. How you doing? Thank you for calling.
I was 12 when Jungle Action came out, and I can't tell you how excited I am to do this interview. Your work really, really was important. You and Steve Gerber were super important to me at that early age. So I just wanted to start by saying thank you.
So thank you. I recently, I was at a convention not too long ago, and a woman came up to me to get one of the Black Panther, Panther versus the Klan books, the one with the Chala lashed to the burning cross, and said she was 6 years old when she read it. And I said, What did you think of that when you saw? I can't even imagine at 6 years old how I would have reacted to that comic if I saw it at that age, you know. And so it's just amazing to me that some of the people have seen these at a very, very young age.
I was 12 to 14 for Panther's Rage, so that was like my prime. So let's go to your early days. You were born in Providence, Rhode Island. In 1945, what were your circumstances? Were your parents workers? What did they do? That kind of just early background stuff.
Oh, like you know, all you need to do is read Ragamuffins, and it's all there.
Okay,
because that's all based. And in fact, I could take you the places that Gene has drawn in there. They're all based on real places and photographs, and a lot of it actually, all these years later, still exists. When little Randy is going up Main Street and he climbs up on the cement wall, he's pretending to be a cowboy, and he's leaping over like a gap in the wall that leads up to where the person's house is. And he's pretending it's a canyon. He's leaping his horse over and everything. All of that is still there. The firehouse, I don't think the store where I actually first saw comics is still there. But that story actually is actually just exactly how I first saw comic books. And my mom would cross me across Main Street to go to kindergarten. And I was supposed to stay on. I was not supposed to go back across Main Street. And eventually, if you've read Ragamuffins, you know I do when I get hit by a truck, but that's another story entirely. But then again, guys, there's always another story. But then anyhow, the first time I went up that street, and I was supposed to stay just on the sidewalk, there was a side street, and I believe the store was called Charlie Murray's. And when I went into that store, in those days, they used to have the comics up on wires, up on the ceiling. And they were hung by metal clips, and they would stream all around the entire, like banners, all around the ceiling. And the store owner could move the comics where he had a hook that he could, you know, grab the wire mesh and then pull the comics around until you get to the book or magazine. But I think it was all comics. I don't think there were any magazines. It was all comics. And I just remember that was love at first sight. I'm 5 years old. It's all this color. It's all this amazing stuff. And so there was probably my first exposure to comics. The first comic I ever got, I must have been 5 or 6 years old. I know it's Hoplo and Cassidy number 66. And there was nothing I loved more than Hoplo and Cassidy when I was a kid. And he's still, like, I got to meet his wife in later years and being involved in doing conventions with that, with Hopalong Cassidy and such. Just it's going to be hard for you to imagine that Hopalong Cassidy was as big as Star Wars. Mm-hmm. When the Hopalong Cassidy newspaper comic strip premiered, opened in the Daily News, it was February of 1951. And over a quarter of a million people lined 42nd Street. And wow. He was standing outside just dressed in his Hoppy outfit. His wife, Grace, was watching from the windows inside the Daily News. And he was out there from 10 in the morning till midnight in the cold. And they hadn't expected those kind of crowds to appear. And he did not leave. And he came up, and they had to bring in firemen, other people to be, because they needed security. They didn't have enough security, and they didn't expect this to go on that way. And he stayed out until midnight. He was out there, you know, from 10 in the morning till midnight. And when he came in, Grace said to him, how could you do that? He said, if they could come out there to see me and stand in the cold, I could stand there to shake their hand and thank them. And that's the kind of guy that William Boyd was.
Oh, nice.
And I've told this story before. I know it's getting a little sidetracked, and I'll get back to the comics in a minute. But just to give you an idea why William Boyd is like one of my heroes. In 1951, William Boyd goes to, I think he's in Alabama. Pretty sure it's Alabama. And Grace told me this story. And he was one of the first people to really merchandise a character. And I don't know whether it was Gimbel's or whether it was Macy's. They're having a big showcase and everybody was lining up. And when Bill gets there, the lines are set up, and you see all these white people in one line, and then you see black people in another line. And William Boyd says to the manager of the store, like, "What's going on here?" And the manager says, "Well, we're going to let the white people go in, and then we'll let the coloreds go in." And William Boyd says, "It's first come, first served, or I'm leaving. I'm not staying here." And he broke the race barrier line in 1951 in Alabama. You know, he's still my hero.
Oh, that's great.
That story told. You asked about the comic. The reason I brought it up is I got my first allowance. I got a dime for the week. And my dad gives me a dime, I guess, in the morning. And then as I go up to school, I stop off at Charlie Murray's, and it was a Hopalong Cassidy comic. And it's Hopalong Cassidy number 65. And I said, "God, let me have that." And he takes the thing down from the rack, and I give him my dime. And when my dad comes home, my dad says, "Well, what'd you do with your allowance?" And I said, "Hey, look, Dad, I got a comic book." And he goes, "Comic book? You spent your whole allowance on a comic book?" So the next week, I get my second dime. And I go, I'm walking back up, and they must have got next month's Hopalong Cassidy. Well, I have to have that. Pull it down from the rack, and now I've got my second Hopalong Cassidy. And when my dad comes on that night and goes, "So what'd you get with your allowance this week?" I got another comic, Dad. I think I lost my allowance for a couple of months. And Dad would have started writing comics. I said, "I'm writing them now, Dad. What are you going to do now?" But nobody ever stopped really reading the comics because I had a comics collection from, I don't remember a time, before that, that I didn't. People didn't read the comics to me. So, I mean, somehow, obviously, I could read enough of those comics to get the story. I don't really recall because I just always read them. I don't remember a time, to be honest with you, I can't remember a time I can't read. And I know my mom tells me that when I would go up to my grandmother's house, I could go up and pick out the records when I was 3 or 4 years old that I wanted to play. I don't know if I could read the things. I don't have any memory of it. I know what she told me. And as with the comics, I do remember, I think it was the measles that, if you got the measles back in those days, they thought you couldn't read. And one of the comics I read, because I had a subscription to show you that obviously I got to read comics. I had a subscription to Dick Tracy from Harvey Comics. By the time I'm 7 or 8, I don't really remember exactly, but I know it's before Harvey's even studied the sense of the Dick Tracy strips. And I remember getting the measles and my mom having to read Dick Tracy to me. And, you know, it's just not the same having Dick Tracy read to you as opposed to reading yourself. And that was during Chester Gould's heyday as a storyteller. It's just incredible. The momentum, the emotion.
You were a fan of his crime stories, basically, right?
Well, and Westerns. I mean, I think I really like the Westerns and the Private. I really like Private Eyes a lot, but the Dick Tracy stuff I liked a lot. I still do.
Oh, that's cool.
That stuff from like 1948 to 1952. I can remember going up to my grandfather's place, and I remember I was growing up in the state of Rhode Island. But my grandfather would get the Sunday news. He didn't get the daily news. So I could only see the Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't go up there all that often, but he stored all of the newspapers that they got. They had a lot of land and they had a lot of buildings on it. He raised chickens among other things. And so they had a room out there where all the newspapers were stacked up toward the ceiling. And I would go through and try not to topple the newspapers on top of myself and try to pull the Sunday news out and read them. So I only got to read the Sundays for Dick Tracy and Hopalong Cassidy and Terry and the Pirates. And I think I was really, I just remember really being captivated by the storytelling in there, even as a kid. And when I got to do a newspaper strip on my own, it was like, that was something the kid in Rhode Island, again, could never have imagined that he would have a chance to do. And I can remember one of the first sequences, and it still stays with me to this day, who's Dick Tracy going up against Cruey Lou, who was obviously one of the first lesbian characters in comic strips for sure. And there's a sequence where she steals Dick Tracy's police car, not knowing that his baby, Bonnie Braids, is in the back seat of the car. And they give police chase after Bonnie Braids. And Bonnie Braids Cruey Lou doesn't know that the baby's in the back till the baby starts crying. And at one point, because Cruey Lou's driving up into the mountains trying to get away and from the helicopters and the police cars chasing her, and the baby's crying, and Cruey Lou reaches back and punches Bonnie Braids, and you go, holy Christmas, what's... And then Cruey Lou abandons the car in the midwoods, and the baby's crying, and wolves are coming around the car. And I think the Sunday ends with the wolves on top of the car and jumping at the windows and everything. And then the next Sunday, it's like, well, there's Dick Tracy and Sam Ketchum arriving in the woods, and they see the car, and they, you know, get out of the helicopter, they're running up, and Dick Tracy thrusts open the back seat, and you see through the doorway into the back seat, there's no Bonnie Braids, there's just torn up the back seat springs where the baby was, and dark splotches where there might be blood. It was like, wow, this was like, you know, it really stayed with me storytelling wise. And the same thing with the Hopalong Cassidy's is one, there's a cliffhanger where Hoppy's riding over a chasm on a bridge, and they cut the wires, and he and Topper go plunging into the falls. And so the next week he's like, you know, I don't know, Hoppy's someplace else. And you go, well, how the hell did he get out of that? And, so as a storyteller, it already was influencing me. And
were you still reading comics into your teens? And also, when was the first time you wrote a letter to a comics editor or to a letters page?
I have no memory of that time period really very much. I was doing so many things. I know I wrote a lot of them. The only ones I really kind of remember are the ones to Shield. I don't remember the letters specifically. Why I remember them particularly is because I wrote to every issue, and I really loved what Stareko was doing. And loved his work.
Mm-hmm. And so as late as that, you were still you were following comics in the 60s then.
If you see the original issues of Shield, you will see I'm almost in every issue.
Oh, cool.
I went to one of Phil Sully's comic conventions.
Uh-huh.
This is probably 1969. I guess it's the first one I went to.
Uh-huh.
I had all of the Steranko Shields hardbound. I really, really loved the stuff. So I had the Shields, and I had the ones that were in Strange Tales, I guess it was.
Strange Tales.
I don't remember, but I love them all hardbound. And I wanted to get them. Jim was at that convention, and I wanted to get them autographed by him.
Yeah.
And so when I went up to him, get a sign, I don't know, we started talking, and I handed him the books, and he said, "You're Don McGregor?" And I'm thinking, how does Jim Steranko know who I am? Remember, I haven't been. I said, "Why should Jim know who I am?" And he says, "Listen, I'm having a party in my hotel room tonight. Don't let anybody know. I'm going to give you the number. Come down and join us tonight." And wow. So that's how I met Jim and got to be friends with Jim. Now, as to why, it wasn't until years later when I started writing, say, the Black Panther books and Killraven. Not so much the Warren stuff, because you got letters for the Warren material, but I was still living in Rhode Island at the time. So when you saw letters to your stories, you were seeing them often months after you wrote them, because the stories didn't appear right away. But when we were doing the Black Panther stuff, we were so tight on deadline. And because they were series, and because Marvel really had, in those days, you know, the letters pages were really a part of the package, especially if you were a big comics fan. And I got very fortunate that, thank God for the readers, because Marvel editorial, not very fond of those books whatsoever. Thank God for the fans, because many of them loved the books and they had an effect on them, and they wrote many, many letters to the books. So later on, when I went to a convention, if I met Dean Mullaney or Frank Lovech, I'm just Peter B. Gillis, I'm Mark Gasper, number of people, since they wrote every book I did, and they wrote sometimes, you know, 10-page letters analyzing what these books were and what they were saying and what they meant to them, I knew who they were immediately. And so, hey, you're Dean Mullaney? Dean, we ought to talk. And like, so many of my friends to this day are people I met through the books.
Mm-hmm.
But you already have that common of a shared love of comics.
Right.
And the fact that they had so much passion for the books. And, you know, again, thank God for the fans.
Yeah, I remember the books that I loved the most were the ones that had the best letter pages, too, because the people that were writing were the people that had similar sensibilities to me. So it was that, it was your books, it was Tomb of Dracula, it was other things that it was like, I look forward to the letters page as much as I did anything else. It was great.
When I went to work at Marvel Comics, and one of the things that was probably dismaying to me, and it only speaks to my naivete at the time, but I really think I thought it was going to be like Stan's bullpen bulletin pages, that the bullpen was, it was everybody urging everybody on to do more and do better and do, you know, and yeah. Just that it was a very, very positive environment. And there was just it was just like any other place filled with politics. And a lot of backstabbing and a lot of stuff where to see writers who were writing about heroes who would then be like trying to climb over the backs of other writers to get titles that they felt were better sellers or would advance their careers or get them into a position to do this or that.
Oh, interesting.
I found it was, for me, dismaying. All I wanted to do was write my stories and leave me alone.
I see. Yeah. So it was not what you expected.
Before we get to Marvel, and I want to hear all of that because that's fascinating to us, but I want to just ask a couple questions about your beginnings of you as a writer. You worked for the Providence Journal. Was that your first professional writing work?
I think the first thing I had published, I had won a poetry thing that was national. And so there was and in fact, it's one of the few things I actually can still quote, because most of the stuff, I could quote other writers' lines to you, not my own. Other people come, "Don, do you remember when you wrote this?" And they will know that line, or you know, because it spoke very directly to them. Pretty much, I'm not going back over my own books because I'm on to the next project. And every project just demands its own particular research, focus on what that book is about and developing the themes of it and the characters, and some of the books more than others, if because I'm asked questions about them, or there's some other project that's being done at a later point in time, and I've got to go back. I know when I went back to do the Killraven graphic novel with Craig, I think that was the first time I had gone back to the stories, and I didn't actually read all the stories. I actually, if I was doing an old Skull scene, I just read his scenes to make sure I had his voice and everything I had written about him. And I had also wisely, in earlier issues, done, for me, wisely, done character histories. So there were pages I could actually just go to, and it would pretty much give me all the information I needed historically about the characters to make sure I wasn't forgetting anything or that I was, you know, screwing something up that I had established for the characters. I was trying to be very, very careful about that. I'm not saying I never made a mistake, but I sure hoped I, I was doing everything I could to make sure I didn't.
Well, since you brought up other writers and saying you could quote that, let me ask one final question before moving on to Alex and Warren Comics. Who were, during this early period, formative period, who were the writers, not comic writers, but other writers that were influential in your own style and in your content?
Probably the writer that had the most profound influence on me was Evan Hunter.
Yeah, exactly.
Is also known as Ed McBain. And I'm not 100% sure of this, but I'm pretty sure I'm remembering this right. At the time, I was reading both Evan Hunter and Ed McBain, but it was before he had revealed that they were the same person. Because I know I started reading, when I read Budwing, I don't think I knew that Evan Hunter who wrote Budwing, which was a regular novel as opposed to a genre piece like the 87th Precinct novels were. I don't think I knew that he was the same writer. You were talking about being a certain age when you read, say, the Black Panther or Killraven, and so they had an impact on you. Well, I think that was the kind of the way it was with Budwing for me. You know, it's all about a guy who wakes up on a park bench one morning in Central Park, and he doesn't know who he is. And the book is either a novel about 24 hours in one person's life trying to find out who they are, or it's an entire lifetime. And it's brilliantly done so that when you finally realize, oh, wait a minute, this can also mean this, and this can also mean that. And it's also a novel about New York City. And to me, Evan Hunter, Ed McBain was the great New York City writer. So even though I was growing up in the state of Rhode Island reading those books, you know, when I got to New York, I didn't even understand up and down. Like I eventually got to think, oh yeah, the numbers go this way and they go that way. If you got the street names, I had no clue. I didn't understand the horizontal grid. I didn't understand anything in the stories in real life that would deal with that. But I did understand the city. He's the one who taught me about storytelling and about not just storytelling, but about human nature. And about how to explore characters. And I remember Dean Maloney saying to me one time, wow, Don, I read the book See Them Die. And I said, as I'm reading it, I said, boy, this book just took Don and blew him away. It truly did. It was like one of those books I just had. It had such emotional impact with me. And probably you take that stuff in, and I think somehow subliminally it influences you as a storyteller. I can remember it seeming like in the book Doll that he had killed Steve Carella. And I remember being on a bus, coming from New York City back to Rhode Island on New Year's Eve. And it looked like he had killed Steve Carella, and he had everybody reacting to Carella's death. And I remember just having tears streaming down my face. And I'm actually talking out loud on the bus. Going, you son of a bitch. You have no right to take Steve Carella. I love Steve Carella too much. And I think it was the same year that Ian Fleming had died, and I knew there would be no new James Bond's novels coming out. And so to lose James Bond and Steve Carella within months was just, you know, probably a little bit too much for me to take at the time. So he was one of the writers. Sterling Siliphant, who wrote the Route 66 series, the thing I really got from Sterling was you could try every time out, and you could try to knock it out of the ballpark. And, yeah, you know, maybe sometimes you didn't. Maybe sometimes you failed. Maybe you struck out. But it wasn't because you weren't trying. And it wasn't because you weren't trying to take the opportunity that you had a chance to reach an audience, to reach people, that you weren't trying to give them something. And I promise you this, maybe a lot of times I just failed miserably. It wasn't because I wasn't given it everything I had at that moment in time.
Were you a fan of the Fantastic Four with Kirby and Stan Lee?
I'm sure you'll see letters, you know, for all of them.
In that also, so you have letters there. Okay.
Don't ask me, but I'm sure every once in a while somebody posts one up on the internet. I'm sure there are Fantastic Four letters, and I'm sure there are Spider-Man letters. I'm sure of that. I know there's some letters in The Flash because, and this goes to show how little artwork was valued back in those days. One day a package arrives at the house here where I'm actually living now. And it's from DC Comics. I'm like, what the heck is this? And it was all the original art to The Flash story that introduced his parents, Barry Allen's parents.
Wow.
And they sent me all the original art for a letter that I'd written to The Flash. And I had that artwork for years. And unfortunately, who can tell the way things, never can tell the way things are going to go. In the 70s, when I was living in New York, I still had all that artwork. And it was at a time when videotape didn't exist. We were a long ways from DVDs and Blu-rays and all that. In those days, it was really hard. The only way you could see a film or a TV show that you really loved, the only way you could see it again was on 16 millimeter.
Right.
And a lot of people in comics were film buffs and fans. And I actually traded the Flash artwork, I think, for an episode of The Avengers with Diana Rigg, because I really loved Diana Rigg and Patrick. Understand that in 1971 or 3 or whatever it was, to be able to have an episode of The Avengers complete was... Now, I used to have film nights, like on Friday nights, and have people over, and I would be able to show films. I haven't watched any of that stuff for 40 years. It's so much easier now to just throw a disc in. You know, who knew that? I mean, okay, you could buy all Diana Rigg Avengers for like, you know, $30.
Now, your first comics work was with Warren Magazines. Was that the first place that you applied your writing to as far as the comic world? Was Warren Magazines?
I told you I was going to comic conventions and Phil Soon's comic conventions. And when I met Jim Steranko and went down to his room that night, I met Alex Simmons, and Alex and I became really good friends. And we, again, understand, all of us had a love for the same things. We all love pop culture. So it wasn't just comics, but it was TV shows, and it was movies, and it was books, and it was, we loved it all. But the one exception be a distinction would be that since we're at a comic book convention, we love comics. And so that kind of was like, you know, put you in a rarer audience than the general audience, which still looked down upon comics. So it was great when you were around people, oh, really understood what you loved about this comic or that comic. And so when I first met Alex, and I was like doing films, shooting stuff on 8mm, back up here in Rhode Island. And I had realized pretty early on, about the time I was 16, 17, somewhere in that time frame, if you wrote the movie, and if you starred in the movie, and if you directed the movie, a couple of things really happened. You always won the fights. And people say, well, Don, I could break every bone in your body. And, you know, what do you mean? I said, well, you and I, we both know that. But see, here in the script, it says I win. And this is how we're going to do that. And I love doing stunt work. So it you know, started to do, I could do my own stunts and fight scenes and put them into a story. So I was already playing around with that. And the second, and even better, was you always got the girl. So this is all infinitely preferable to real life. And I thought, well, I'll just devote my life to this. This is great. When I met Alex, again, we were all in, like, we both loved the Republic serials. We loved stunt work. We loved film. Mm-hmm. And so we really started doing films together. And Alex would come up from New York, and we would do films together. But we also both loved comics. Alex and I were doing a lot of fight scenes together because I knew that I could trust Alex, and Alex knew that he could trust me. Because when you're doing stunt work and when you're doing action fight scenes, now you got to be really careful. A lot of times you're doing with people who, I was doing a stunt sequence, and I had a real machete that I found in some woods at one point in time. So I was doing a fight scene, and I didn't know anything about fake weapons. So we're using the real, you know, I was working out the choreography for the fight, and it was on a dock. I was on a dock over water, and the stunt was supposed to be that the bad guy would swing at me with the machete, and I would jump back, and the sweep would go past me, and I would come in, grab his arm, and then punch him, and then take him, throw him off the dock into the water. So we had rehearsed it a number of times, but a lot of times, you know, when the camera starts going, people suddenly put everything into it. And this guy actually kind of like lunged forward, whereas before I was, good thing I was leaping back, because the blade of the machete actually tore through my shirt and went right across my stomach. Now, fortunately, I was going back, so it only really basically left a red line across there. Now, and because it's film, I didn't stop. I kept doing the stunt, you know, grabbed his arm, hit him, threw him in the water, and then looked at him down. So what the fuck are you doing? That's a real machete. You could have killed me with that thing. And I bring that story up because with Alex, I think the one time we were doing a stunt where he was swinging an axe at my head. I had to get underneath it. And I knew with Alex, you could do a stunt like that, that we were both going to be being careful, that we knew that you had one mistake here and somebody's going to get seriously hurt. So we started doing our own stunts together. And then I decided, well, and this is how Detectives Incorporated actually first get created. They weren't created for comics. They were created for film, for Alex and I to play on film. And I had written a screenplay called Death Game in Three Dimension. And that was the first Detectives Incorporated. And then I actually wrote a short story because I was actually taking stories around New York. And I wrote one called Assassin Street. And I was taking that to places like Mike Shane Mystery Magazine. And I've been talking to the Mike Shane people because I wasn't trying for comics. I love comics. I didn't have anything against comics. But then I said to Alex, hey, why don't we do our own comic? We're going to go to the comic, you know, we're going to go to Phil Suling's thing next year. Why don't we do our own comic? And that became the first Detectives Incorporated.
Oh, yeah, right, and right. So yeah, I remember, because that was your first draft, basically, of that. Is that right?
We actually did it, Alex. I mean, it was like, all right, we even had deadline problems because Alex had to come up and finish it days before the convention in New York. He came up to Rhode Island. We sat down every day to get it finished and get book put together and collated. And it had a Pepto-Bismol pink cover.
Uh-huh.
And there's very few copies of that I know of that exist. I think Doug Bench had one. I'm not sure if I know of anybody else who actually have copies of the book. I'm sure they do. We finished the book up in time for the convention. This is about 1970.
Yeah, 71 is about Warren,
If I hadn't done that, the Warren stuff probably would not have happened. Alex and I went to the Phil Suling convention that year. We were young guys. We didn't want to, and we have to sit behind the table trying to sell a damn book. We wanted to go out and have a good time at the convention. In those days, somebody actually would like man the table and they would sell other people's books. So we actually, I don't remember what you had to pay them. They took some kind of percentage, I guess, or whatever. And it was worth it to us to do it. And we could go around and I could take, my Detectives Incorporated around and hand it out to people to show what I could do.
Yeah.
It wasn't like there was an active pursuit. Like I was even actually thinking about, well, I'm going to be doing comics, because at the same time I was writing stories and I was still filming things. I loved all of it and I was doing all of it. So whatever project I was involved in at any point in time, that's the one where my focus and my energy and intent was. And they had panels, as they do today. Jim Warren was on a panel.
Ah, okay.
And as we went into the to see the panel, I handed out Detectives Incorporated to everybody going up on the stage. Yeah. Because I had realized, even at that point in time, especially when there were panels, if the people weren't talking, they oftentimes they were scarcely listening to what the other people were saying. It wasn't that important to them. They were involved in their own thing.
Yeah.
And Jim Warren was up there and said, anytime anybody was speaking, the other people were looking at Detectives Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can see that Pepto-Bismol pink cover, like anywhere from the audience. Now, and just to go to show that I had no, I don't recommend this as a way to go. It shows that I had no, there was no plan. I thought, well, this will get me published at Warren magazines. There was no thought to that at all. Most of the time, anything I've said or done, 10 seconds before I said or did it, I had no idea I was going to say or do it.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice and I are sitting in the audience. And Jim Warren is up on panel. And I've told the story with Jim Warren present in one of the last conventions I'd seen him at. This may now be, you know, two decades ago. It was definitely during the 90s, probably. Probably around about the time I was doing Lady Ride and Zorro. I think somewhere in that time frame. For a while, Jim Warren came back. And he was doing a convention in New York. And we... And I met up with Jim. It was the first time I'd seen Jim in quite a while at that point.
Right.
And so, and Jim will tell you all these stories are absolutely the way they happened. Jim was talking about, at that point in time, Warren was talking about going mail order only with his magazines. And because he was going mail order, he could put content into the stories that you couldn't do if you were selling in the grocery stores or the mom and pop stores or wherever. And it was going to make history. His comics were going to be the best comics ever. No comics were going to be as good as his. He was doing the best comics, and he was doing his little Jim Warren launch. I raised my hand, and Jim Warren points to me, and he goes, yeah, what's your question, or something like that. And I got up and said, well, if that's true, Mr. Warren, why are you publishing the kind of crap you're publishing? This didn't go over too well with Jim. And he just, you know, he went ballistic up on stage, whatever, which I don't blame him, to be honest with you. And but when it was over, when the panel was over, Jim Warren came rushing off that panel, came down, going up there and came to where Alex and I, and, you know, we're getting up, getting ready to leave. And he goes, hey, Hot Shot, which is what he started to call me that weekend. Hey, Hot Shot, come over here. Then my name became Hot Shot, I think, for quite a while. And he was a big Terry and the Pirates fan. And he continued to refer to me as Hot Shot Charlie.
Hot Shot Charlie, good.
How dare you ask me a question like that in a public forum or something like that? You know, and he's going, I said, well, I think it's an honest question or something. I don't know. I'm 20 some years old. What do I know? And Jim goes, just name one story I ever did that was crap. Now, I'll be honest with you, Jim, Alex, it's not a thing I would do now because I understand it could have consequences to a person's career later on. But I wasn't in the business at the time. I didn't know anything about that kind of thing. And I named a story that I really, and I still legitimately to this day, I'm sorry, the story is crap, okay? Well, I'm not going to tell you what story it is. But Jim Warren says, oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? All right, come with me. And Alex and I follow Jim, and he goes into, in those days, they used to show movies.
Yeah.
They might have been actually 24/7, but I don't want to swear to that. But if they didn't, they showed them late into the night. Because again, that's the only way you could see old stuff was like if you went to some kind of film retrospective and the comic conventions, Phil would have a thing where they were showing old movies. I don't believe I ever attended any of them because we were always busy doing stuff, other things. So I was not really there. But we go into the darkened room. It's huge, huge room. And I can see that Jim is walking down, looking up the aisles. Look, he's obviously looking for somebody. And eventually he sees the person and he motions the person over. And the 6'6" black guy comes out and Jim Warren goes, "Don McGregor, this is Billy Graham. Billy Graham, this is Don McGregor."
Oh,
Billy,
wow. Drew.
"Don McGregor, tell Billy Graham his work is crap." And because it absolutely is true, I said, "I didn't say the artwork was crap. I said the story was crap." I think he was amazed that I didn't lose my cool about it, or I didn't get flustered about it, or I don't know what.
Yeah.
I swear to God, if I'd gone up to Jim Warren at that convention and said to Jim Warren, "Geez, Jim, I love your books. Your books are the best books, comics ever. Nobody does comics as good." None of what happened after that would have happened. It only happened because of the sequence of events that I just said to you. Jim Warren actually takes a step back. He says, "I tell you what, hotshot, play your cards right. I'll take you out to dinner tonight." So I end up going out to dinner. Alex and I go out to dinner with Billy and with Jim. Despite that auspicious beginning, Billy Graham and Alex and I have become very, very, very good friends.
Oh,
I think
wow.
really that Billy saw in Alex and I that we were younger versions of himself. Mm-hmm. Like these young guys who just loved comics, loved everything, and like nothing was impossible. And I think Billy really, this is my interpretation of it, and you could ask Alex what he felt about it, but I think that was part of what he enjoyed about it. And we got to be good friends. And when I needed a place to stay in New York City, I would come and stay with Billy up in Harlem, or I would stay with Alex in Spanish Harlem. So this now became a real big influence in my life because it was just opening entire new worlds for me. You know, Billy took me to, say, Jeff Jones, and to at that time, Louis Simonson was with Jeff, and they had parties for comics people.
Right.
I don't know whether it was once a week, once a month, but Billy was like invited. So Billy said, "Come on, Don, we're going to go." And that was the first time sitting around a room filled with people who all love comics.
Yeah.
So I got to do a lot of stuff. I had a lot of exposure, you know, because a lot of white people would be continually telling me, "Well, you can't go up to Harlem at 2 o'clock in the morning. You're going to get killed, Don. You're going to, you know." And it would always be white people trying to make you afraid. What the hell that was all about. And later this year, hopefully, we're still working on the production values because we're going to reshoot all of Billy Graham's artwork for Saber and Exploitation of Everything Dear. We're going to come out in a deluxe volume with all of Billy's artwork restored. Mm-hmm. And it's in the process. In fact, I owe his granddaughter a letter. I will get to it. I talked to Dean. I have talked with Dean this week, and it is one of the things that I will get around to doing. Now, that doesn't end the Warren stories yet.
Right.
It takes you to the point that, yes, I've met Jim Warren. We've gone out to dinner. And the next day, I was coming into a big room, into the convention. I don't know the display room, I guess. But there was an open section in the beginning, and Jim Warren was standing, and he had a painting that was covered. It had a coverlet over it. Jim says, "Hey, hotshot, come over here." So I come walking over, and you really think you're a hotshot, don't you, Don? And I said, "No, I don't." And I really didn't. I mean, just trying to do the best I can, you know. Like, so Jim Warren goes, "Okay, I've got a Vaughn Bordet painting under here."
Oh, wow.
"And I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to lift this coverlet up, and I'm going to count down from 10. I'm going to give you 10 seconds. And then when I get to one, I want you to give me a story for this painting."
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's great.
And I go, in my head, you know, like, okay. And so Jim starts 10, 9, 8. And he's lifted up the thing. There's the Vaughn Bordet painting. And I'm looking at it, and I got nothing. 7, 6, 5, 4, and I'm still staring at it like a deer in headlights. You know, there's like 3, 2, and the one thing I know, guys, there's only one thing I know. I don't have anything in mind. I have no idea, but I know that when he gets to one, I'm going to start talking.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 2-1, and I said, "Okay, there's two guys," and everyone said, whoa, "Hey, hotshot. I got professional writers. I'm not going to mention any of the names now. Who want to do stories? This is a Vaughn Bordet painting. You think I'm going to give it to a nobody like you? Are you kidding me? Get out! You're not getting a Vaughn Bordet painting." So we had this discussion, and okay, I'm not doing it. 4 months later, I get a call from Jim Warren. By that time, I was writing for him, and I had started writing stories. And let's get this very, very clear. You were getting $25 a story, and they owned everything. So if you did an eight-page story for them, but I got really, really spoiled. My editor was Archie Goodwin, and Archie was just one of the best people in the business, fair, honest, and anything he told you was to make your story better. That had nothing to do with his own ego or the way he would write a thing. It was about your story. So I had written a number of stories for them, and you get the same amount of money. I think I wrote one eight-pager, then I started doing 10-page stories, and then I started doing 12-page stories, and you still got $25 a story, no matter what, how long it was. So you can honestly see I was not in this for the money, obviously. It was like, no, what is this story going to be out? What is the story going to be about? And how can I, you know, what can I do with this now that I have a chance to tell this story? Somewhere along the way, I'd sold a number of stories, like a half dozen stories to them or something. And I got to know Jim. And when I was in the city, sometimes I would go work with Jim on the magazine at night. And you can help me do some stuff on the magazine.
Huh.
I was good friends. Billy was the art director. He was the first Black art director in comics. Billy was the art director at the time. So I was seeing Billy. When I would go into the city, I'd either be staying with Billy or I'd be staying with Alex. At that point, I get a call from Jim Warren. He goes, I'm going to send you the scripts I've got for this, that people have done for this Vaughan Bidet painting. And I want you to take one of them and I want you to write the script around somebody else's script. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm not interested.
Okay.
He goes, no, Don, I know what I'm paying you. Can't afford to turn it down. You're going to be involved with the cover. I said, I'm not interested. If you want to send me a copy of the painting so I can look at it and come up with my own story, then I'll do it. Other than that, but don't send me any scripts because I'm not reading anybody else's scripts.
Yeah.
It wasn't because I thought I was better than anyone else. I just had no interest in doing it. All I wanted to do was tell my own stories. I don't know what would be wrong with that. So finally, Jim kind of gave in and said, okay, I'm going to send you the painting. And that ended up being the first story that actually saw print. This is the first story I wrote, but it's the first one that saw print. And because of Billy put my name and Tom Sutton's name on the cover of the magazine because the creators' names didn't, you know, the artists and writers, they did not get put on the cover of Vaughan magazines. You know, Billy ended up doing it. And I didn't even know the story had been drawn. I'm still living up in Rhode Island. One day I get a package and then there's Creepy Magazine with my name on the cover and then the lead story and Tom Sutton had drawn it. I had not seen any of it before it. And Tom did everything I asked for.
Nice.
If I wanted continuity shots, if I wanted point of view shots, if I wanted reverse angle shots, if I wanted it through a sniper scope, whatever it was, Tom did it and more. Archie Goodwin edited it, and man, was I being set up. Boy, I was like, oh, it's always going to be this way. The story's going to come out like exactly the way I wanted it to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I, you know, was ready for a rude awakening, but that was down the road.
Hmm. And then just a couple bullets for the audience. So When Wakes the Dreamer is listed as your first story, but it did not see print until 1973 in Eerie 45. But the one that saw print first was The Fadeaway Walk in Creepy 40 in 1971. You had the first interracial kiss in Warren's Creepy 43 in 1972, The Men Who Called Him Monster. And in that story, The Men Who Called Him Monster, did you get any mail on that? Was there any fan reaction at the time?
Well, the weird thing, now we have to go back on that a little bit.
Uh-huh.
When that scene was written, I didn't write an interracial kiss in that scene, in that story. It was about a private eye, a Black private eye, who's looking for a missing teenager. Mm-hmm. And he goes to see the kid's teenage girlfriend. And she's working at a McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
And script was drawn overseas by Jose Gonzalez, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks great. And then the detective looks at Sidney Poitier.
Yeah.
And he's asking her about her boyfriend, about her missing boyfriend and what happened. And I really, you had very tight space in the morning. Actually, you didn't have a lot of room. And so all that scene had to happen in one page. And so I wanted to try to get as much emotional impact as I could out of it. And in my descriptions to the artist for the last panel, I said, this is the clincher. And what I meant was, I'm using American slang for this is the one that should emotionally slam the scene home to the audience. Mm-hmm. The artist reads it and thinks I meant, okay, they kiss. And they have this passionate kiss. Well, it doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, here's this older guy kissing this young girl who's like worried about her boyfriend. Like, why? What is that scene doing there? But it does make history for being the first interracial kiss in American comics.
In American comics, yeah.
Later on, it'll happen on purpose in Killraven.
Now, you mentioned Tom Sutton, but there's also Richard Corbin illustrated stories of yours, right. Reed Crandall also. Were you fans of guys like Reed Crandall and Corbin at the time?
I love Reed Crandall. I was very fortunate. I had an uncle who was a real asshole. He really was terrible. I'm not going to say, I'll try again not to mention any names. He was growing up in the 40s. So at that time, he had really great taste in comics. And when I would go up to my grandma's house, when I went up to the attic, I found all these old comics. And he had the Little Wise Guy, Charles Barrow, Daredevil stuff, a lot of the Reed Crandall military comics, Blackhawk stuff. Unfortunately, my mom burned all those comics in about 19, probably when I was about 10, 12 years old. I used to tease her about it all the time. And I think it was making mom feel too bad. I said, nah. I would say, you know, mom, if you hadn't burned those comics.
Yeah, late 50s, yeah.
So I had exposure to those comics pretty early on, you know. So along with the comic strips, which I really dearly loved, and then I was buying my own comics, you know, as well. A lot of them would have been Westerns. I really liked the Westerns a lot. A lot of exposure to Milton Caniff. I can't say that Caniff had a lot of influence on me in the earlier stuff because I hadn't seen enough. When I was doing the Marvel stuff, it's not really very much Will Eisner inspired because I hadn't seen enough Eisner at the time. But there's a pop culture full circle kind of thing where somebody else is. I was more influenced by Steranko. All those interior title page designs, say for Panther's Rage and Panther versus the Klan. I always loved that kind of thing when I saw Jim doing it in the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. And I just took that idea and then ran with it and did my own versions of it. But I do pay homage to it with Malice by Crimson Moonlight is very much inspired by Doc Remy's Hellhound Kill. That's true. Did.
So were you a fan of the EC comics?
Well, Felstein did some incredible things. But I didn't see a lot of the EC comics when I was younger. Huh. And I'm not sure when I had my first exposure. I loved a lot of the EC stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't remember where I first got exposure to them. I'm sure where they were reprinting them somewhere, but I don't remember when that would have been. One of the first times would have been when I was doing stuff at Warren, because Warren, I don't know if Flory Ackerman did it or if Warren had done it or they did it together. They did a hardcover. That's probably my first real exposure. I really love that stuff. I think some of that is so far ahead of its time. Especially some of the shock suspense stories as well. And Gaines was so far ahead of his time. Outstanding.
Outstanding. This is awesome. Thanks so much, Don, for chatting with us today. Let's return in a couple weeks for part two of Don McGregor, The Early Years, here at the Comic Book Historians Podcast with Alex Grant and Jim Thompson. Cheers.